You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
My name is Rowan Conway. I'm Director of Research and Innovation here at the RSA. And I'm delighted to welcome you here today for our special lunchtime event. It's my great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's distinguished speaker. Dirk Philipson is a Professor of Economic History and Senior Fellow at the Keenan Institute for Ethics at Duke University in the USA. His work and teaching is focused on sustainability and the history of capitalism. And his most recent research is focused on GDP as a dominant measure of success in internal economic affairs, driven, he says, by the question that he couldn't answer from one of his students once upon a time, which led to a really rich research stream into why GDP. His work also includes historical explorations of alternative measures for well-being, which is why it's very interesting for me and some of the work that we're doing in the value of connected communities and well-being. He's recently published a book on this topic, which I have here, and he'll be talking to, called Little Big Number, How GDP Came to Rule the World and What to Do About It. And here at the RSA, we're really interested in thinking about the economy and economic measures in more depth. We are developing a new programme of research and events which are looking at what it would take to build a flourishing and fair future economy, maximising the scope for individual and collective creativity and being sustainable and having sustainability and justice at its core. One of the specific issues we want to be looking at is the viability of alternative social progress measure to go alongside GDP, such as a well-being index. So there's obviously a great deal we can learn from your work, Dirk. And it's a really particular pleasure to have you here today. So without further ado, I'm going to pass over to Dirk, and please welcome Professor Dirk Philipson.
Thank you so much for inviting me to your lovely city. I am very excited to be here, talk at RSA, in part because my American colleagues insist that UK audiences, on average, are much more sophisticated, much more open to sort of more systemic critiques, as I will give to you today. Let me start by saying that how I got into this. I've been teaching some version of the history of capitalism for a very long time. It's a course that always raises some very difficult and profound questions, often questions that deal with deeply internalized assumptions about basic things like human motivations or the workings of markets. To what extent do they guide our lives? Have we perhaps bought into truths that are simply not true? As Mark Twain pointed out, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure. That ain't so. So today I'd like to explore with you one such presumed truth, one such assumption that you find everywhere. I came to investigate these assumptions more closely in response to what seemed at first a fairly simple question by one of my students. How do we know we're on the right track? Yes, indeed, how do we? Tempted at first to give some canned answers about existing economic and social indicators, I quickly realized how complex of a question it was. In essence, it was asking, is the economy as currently organized actually serving human needs? Now, rather than taking you through all the possible layers of this question, let me start with two observations that I think will help us get to the core challenge. One, while you may not personally subscribe to this, the most controlling assumption today underlying most economic activities and indeed most policymaking is that growth is good. Not only good, but essential. Essential for success and well-being. Essential for prosperity and progress. Around the world, nations have hitched their wagons to this very idea, and they continue to do so, even though there's mounting evidence that this obsession with growth may actually drive us off the cliff. Two, it's not enough to be critical of or even oppose the consequences of these assumptions, things like escalating inequality or climate change. In order to change the direction of our collective journey, we have to come to grips with the history of the assumption and the many ways in which this assumption lodged its way into prevailing thought and economic systems around the world, from the personal to the political. Consider this. If someone says to you, "We need to grow," you would probably respond by asking, "Grow what?" You might even ask, "Why?" or "What for?" To say growth is good, of course, is in itself not very precise. There's a wide range of things that can be grown. Those things can be good, bad, or indifferent. We may like the tree to grow or our children to grow, but we probably don't like the fungus on the tree to grow or the malignant tumor to grow in a family member. No doubt, when politicians or economists around the world talk about growth, they predictably reflect a range of cultural and ideological differences, and they imagine different types of growth, and certainly want growth for very different reasons. Lift people out of poverty, perhaps, or generate the money necessary to build a strong military force. Oxford University's Kay Raworth, I believe in this very room, has noted how world leaders are adding forever more qualifiers to their call for more growth. They now talk about sustainable growth and green growth or balanced growth. But if we want to know what exactly they mean by that, we have to investigate how they measure growth. In order to know whether something is growing, one needs clearly defined metrics. I can't measure the growth of a tree in Celsius or the alleviation of poverty in miles per hour. Here's where our story gets both fascinating and, I think, quite troubling. The differences in qualifiers, the differences in emphasis and regulatory policies between different governments and different political leaders fails to highlight a central reality. From Buenos Aires to Washington, from Beijing to London, governments around the world measure growth in ways that are almost identical. And that way is called gross domestic product, or GDP. It's the track determining each economy's direction. The key thing to observe here is that qualifiers like green or balanced merely speak to speed or makeup of the train, but not to the universal goal of exponential growth, not to where the train is taking us. For me, as a historian, it raised a fascinating question, and you can help me out here. Has there ever been a single set of values, a single paradigm, or a single ideology, if you will, that is as universal as the aspiration to grow GDP? I'm not sure what the answer is, but as a number, GDP's importance is likely unrivaled in the world. Indeed, many other key metrics like investment or income or wealth or standard of living are a direct function of it. So returning to our initial question, if someone says, "We need to grow GDP," the immediate question should be, what are you asking us to grow and why? Let me pause here for just a second and reflect on some readily discernible characteristics of GDP before we explore its substance and history. One, though likely one of the most important political questions, what does GDP growth mean, is rarely asked. On the contrary, we can find that the benefits of GDP growth are routinely just simply taken for granted. Two, among those who do question the utility of GDP, few inquire into its origins or why and how it spread its tentacles around the world. I was astonished, for instance, to find that nobody had ever written a comprehensive history of this metric. And three, I noticed that, indeed, once a person starts to question the logic of GDP growth, some highly instructive hell breaks loose. People from right to left tend to get quite unsettled, and they are quick to tell you why. GDP growth is necessary for prosperity, they say. Or, do you want the poor of the world to stay in misery by denying them the benefits of growth? Or, as a reviewer of my book in Fortune magazine claimed, rather remarkably, I think, quote, "We measure growth with GDP because that's what people want," Now remember, these are common responses all based on very broad assumptions delivered long before any clarity has been established as to what exactly we're talking about. So let me briefly inquire as to what GDP actually measures before moving on to where it comes from. Most of you have probably heard the standard definition, which is GDP measures goods and services produced. Economists put this into a deceptively simple formula. Now, at first sight, this seems to make perfect sense, until we look a little closer. What GDP measures, it turns out, is simply output, volume of activity, and of course, only volume of activity in the official market. It is, in many ways, an astonishing realization. GDP does not measure quality. It does not measure real costs. It does not measure purpose or development, just output. It says nothing, in short, about whether its growth actually contributes to our well-being. It's like saying activities at NHS way up. I think such a headline would strike most of us as rather bizarre. What activities are we talking about? Did more people get sick? Did they use more procedures? Or did they hire more people? Did they simply spend more money? What, above all, was the result? Were people better off or worse off? Another way to put it is to say, according to the reigning logic of GDP, the more we turn life into commodities, trees into lumber, fossils into fuel, atmosphere into carbon dumps, lakes into resorts, land into parking lots, human skills into wage labor, education into investments, the better. Now, why is that a problem? Because in this regime, what we count is utterly indiscriminate. The good as much as the bad or the hazardous. Indeed, things like oil spills, accidents, and addictions are among the most favorable events as measured by GDP. They require many goods and services that make GDP go up. When we use GDP as a measure of prosperity and welfare, as we do, divorce is better than a happy marriage, long commutes are better than walking to work, shopping is better than playing a musical instrument, and of course, plundering the planet is better than safeguarding the ecosystem for future generations. It's this very logic that defines mainstream understandings of prosperity and progress. It is a logic at its core that needs people to live beyond their means and nature to be pushed beyond its limits. The UK's former Economics Commissioner for Sustainable Development, Tim Jackson, recently summarized the consumption side of this logic. He said, quote, "We spend money we don't have on things we don't need, in order to create impressions that won't last on people we don't care about." Now, assuming that we're not all insane, the key question then becomes, how did this happen? And I think the history matters a great deal to understand it. Without looking at origins, in fact, neither the nature nor the global reign of GDP makes any sense. So very briefly, it happened in three major developments. The initial blueprint of GDP was developed in England and the US in response to a crisis so large that it was threatening to bring down entire societies. We now know this crisis as the Great Depression. Now, a graph like this can trace the severity of the crisis, but, and this is important to note, at the time of the Great Depression, no one in government or business possessed any of this information. No one knew the big picture of what was going on. No one even knew basic things like actual numbers of unemployed, levels of investment, unused productive capacities, etc. It was literally the economic dark ages. And it was in this moment of great crisis that accountants Simon Kuznets in the US and Colin Clark in the UK, chief among them, put together the first sets of what they called national income and product accounts. And it provided vital information for programs such as the New Deal. It was, based on my research, an enormous and massive labor of love. Remember, these people had access only to the most rudimentary information. They had no computers, no government agency providing them with lots of support, just some census data, some surveys they send out, and pencil and paper. Now, I thoroughly investigated how they put together these first accounts and realized that something was almost entirely missing from today's conversations about GDP. What they put together, the blueprint of GDP, was a result of compromise, a result of limited data, and a result of profound disagreements on what to count and how to count it. Things like, should we count housework? Or what is an end product anyway? Today, most of these debates and disagreements are largely invisible, hidden behind a long, settled way of doing things. Bringing them back into light, we realize that GDP is not at all objective. In fact, the choices that went into its design are no less subjective as something like well-being or happiness surveys. They shed light into narrow aspects of economic activities, and they often do so accurately, but objective they most certainly are not. And in some cases, they literally defy common sense, as when they count plundering of natural resources as a plus, or ignore most domestic labor, or consider military operations as a final product. At first, in other words, the blueprint of GDP provided vital, albeit very limited, information was essential to dealing with depression and crisis, which brings us to the second step. With German and Japanese aggression mounting in the late 1930s, the sudden imperative in both Britain and the US was to crank up military production of things like planes, tanks, and equipment as much and as fast as possible. Here's where GDP blueprint really proved its value. Accountants had gathered the necessary information to show war planners how exactly to do that. They showed how much steel and how many workers and what kind of machinery was necessary to produce, say, X number of tank turrets, all without starving civilian needs or taking away necessary resources from the production of other necessities like ships or guns. The economist Paul Samuelson did not exaggerate when he called World War II an economist's war. The US and Britain had the data. The Germans and the Japanese did not. This is a graph showing how the US outproduced its adversaries in planes. The same could be shown for tanks, guns, or destroyers. But the point here is that it turns out that GDP accounts are very, very good in cranking up output. But then, and this is the third major historical development, even before World War II was over, all the old problems and many new ones knocked on the door. How to prevent another Great Depression? How to feed and employ all the returning veterans? How to rebuild and stabilize entire societies? How to stem the tide of people pushing for radical change, even revolution? How to foil the expansion of communism? Through various mechanisms, chief among them Bretton Woods, IMF, the World Bank, and the Marshall Plan, the short answer on which political leaders in the West settled was growth of output, growth of GDP. Why did they do that? Because increased output offered a promise to nearly everyone. Jobs and incomes to workers, refrigerators and cars to consumers, profits to entrepreneurs, stability to politicians. The result between 1944 and the time of the Soviet Union collapse in 1992, every country in the world hitched its wagon to GDP growth. After the war, in short, GDP moved from a descriptive tool to a prescriptive target, from measure to goal. Despite its limitation, it thus effectively defined the very course and direction of the greatest expansion of wealth and output in human history. Around the world, without debate about what it measured or how it came to be, the chief political and economic imperative became growth of GDP. One critical consequence was this. GDP effectively replaced political deliberation about purpose and direction of economic activity. In other words, we essentially stopped asking the most basic question: what are we growing and why? All kinds of important questions, like how to promote justice or empower citizens or create meaningful work, became secondary to the overarching goal of GDP. Good idea. For all practical purposes, in other words, the question of more of what disappeared from public debate. Without any debate, in fact, more became synonymous with better. Now, here's an equally astonishing sidebar. More, in the case of GDP, represents not linear, but, of course, exponential growth. At a very conservative growth rate of 2%, a doubling of economic output every 35 years. By this logic, taking 1900 as the base year of 1, this translates into economic output that is 8 times as large by 2000, an incredible 64 times as large another 100 years later. And yes, another 100 years later, 512 times as large. Of course, if the growth rate is 3%, the economic output in 2200 would have to be some 30,000 times as large. Now, it's a remarkable, not to say remarkably insane logic. Yet it is what currently defines mainstream economic wisdom. One can see why the physics professor Albert Bartlett argued that the greatest shortcoming of the human race is our inability to understand the exponential function. The rationale underlying the logic of GDP growth, of course, was and is that increased consumption is good. Naomi Klein called it the ideology of the goods life rather than the good life. Former World Bank economist Herman Daly has pointed out that following this logic treats the earth like a business in liquidation. Some have likened it to the logic of the cancer cell. In practical terms, of course, it did not take long for exponential growth in output to run up against serious problems. Conflicts over markets, wars over resources, the commodification of ever more aspects of life, and most importantly, the limits imposed by a finite ecosystem. Depletion of resources, degradation of soil, air, and water, and now most familiar to us, climate change. This is an illuminating way to show how many of the hidden complexities and correlations between Earth system trends and socioeconomic trends, or between, simply put, what is happening in our natural environment as a direct response to what actions we take as human societies. Just a brief few highlights. Here we see exponential growth of GDP really picking up steam after its invention. Here we see the same kind of growth in carbon dioxide emissions. Here we have our collective consumption of fertilizers. And here the exponential intensification of ocean acidification. So this set of graphs put together by the International Geosphere Biosphere Program, I think, really tells a powerful story. Remember, GDP does not account for any of these problems. On the contrary, its ledgers register as a plus things like resource exploitation, oil spills, and spending beyond our means. For all intents and purposes, I would argue, that was and is a global system of accounting without accountability. For future generations, it's also something that we might call exploitation without representation. The young and as yet unborn don't have a voice in our use of their non-renewable resources. An analogy might actually help clarify the historical role of GDP. If a doctor prescribed a doubling of calories to a starving patient, say from 200 to 400 calories, no one would object. No one would raise questions about the origins or quality of the calories. It would simply be a good thing. The same is true if the doctor's prescription would take the patient from 400 to 800 calories, or even from 800 to 1600. All this would be making the patient stronger, healthier, and more resilient. A good thing. Except that at this point, we decided collectively to measure health by caloric intake. By the time the prescription would further double to 3,200 calories, some of you may begin to raise questions. But then once we double intake once more from 3,200 to 6,400 calories, most of us would probably agree, independent of our age, nationality, race, or creed, this is eventually going to kill the patient. The problem is, by now, the entire healthcare system and the entire healthcare profession is premised on the idea that more calories translate into better health. The same logic applies to GDP. So let me at this point very briefly summarize some of the key lessons from the history of GDP before moving on to considerations of where to go from here. GDP as a tool is neither good nor bad. How we use it is the problem. GDP is no more objective than, say, a happiness index. GDP is not a product of democratic deliberation or elite politics, much less corporate conspiracies. It is, in fact, a purely technocratic instrument. GDP was created as a response to crisis and war. It thus cannot and does not address the challenges of the 21st century. GDP is not just a bad measure of welfare, it is also a very bad economic indicator. GDP is not just a measure, but the primary goal of economic policies. Indeed, it defines what an economy is. GDP as the operating system of modern economies impacts virtually all aspects of our lives, whether we like it or not. By using indiscriminate output as the core metric for goods, services, income, wealth, status, even prosperity, success, and progress, GDP is both outdated and dangerous. But, and just as important, as the central metric defining the economy today, the very nexus where core challenges like inequality or climate change coalesce and come together, replacing GDP with smarter metrics also represents a unique opportunity for fundamental change. Time then to shift focus and begin looking forward. What we measure really matters, for it largely determines what we aim for. It also defines what we get paid for. Under the GDP regime, planting a tree doesn't count. Cutting it and down and turning it into lumber does. Creating communities of fellowship and learning doesn't count. Jailing people does. Leaving oil in the ground and protecting a healthy ecosystem does not count. Extracting and fracking and burning it does. Just imagine for a minute how different all of our lives would be if we turned that logic right side up. If we used available smart metrics that actually reflect what we want, what we democratically decide is good for us. So what we measure really matters. Three well-established metrics make the point. So here we have a well-known metric of GDP per capita and, you know, predictable results. Powerhouses like the U.S. look very good. Change that metric just by a little bit and add things like life foundations of well-being or basic human needs or the opportunity to progress, and the picture already changed quite considerably. Now add something like the health of the planet and something very interesting happens. The U.S. actually ends up at the bottom of the list. In a country, surprisingly, like Costa Rica, with less than one-third of the per capita GDP of the U.S. comes out at top. All of which is bringing us back to the fundamental question. What do we want from our economy? Here, I think it is worth remembering that none of the great economists or moral philosophers of the past considered growth a worthy goal for its own sake. Most merely saw it as a means to allow for human development. And they all understood that it had to come to an end. John Stuart Mill thought that the mere increase in production and accumulation is a product of what he called coarse minds. Your honorary Englishman, Karl Marx, famously talked about the realm of freedom that lies beyond the realm of necessity. Growth as an initial good, but never more than a temporary necessity. John Maynard Keynes, in his well-known letter to his grandchildren, called the love of money and growth and possessions a disgusting morbidity. And not exactly mincing words, described it as, quote, one of those semi-criminal, semi-pathological propensities that hopefully soon would be handed over with a shudder to the specialists in mental disease. As you can see, not much love here for indefinite, much less exponential growth. And then, of course, bringing all this to a point, and very familiar to anyone who has ever watched an RSA video, the English economist Kenneth Boulding quipped, anyone who believes that exponential growth is possible on a finite planet is either insane or an economist. But this is precisely where we are. Ask mainstream economists and politicians around the world what we need, and their answers are almost always premised on some version of economic growth. And the reason is simple. The very operating system of the GDP regime requires growth. People don't. The system does. In contrast, ask natural scientists, and they will give you some version of the fact that we need to stop growth, which I think points to the central contradiction of our time. Global economies that need to grow and a planet that simply cannot grow. And here it is worth remembering that it is up to us what economy we want to live in, while the parameters of the planet's ecosystem we change at our own peril. Of course, ultimately, the question of purpose goes far beyond growth or no growth. Rather than following the mindless goal of GDP growth, we could decide to have a broad conversation about the purposes of economic activities. Outside of the logic of the GDP regime, broad agreement on goals and direction is likely much less difficult than one would imagine. Research strongly suggests as much. Again, smart measures matter a great deal, for they both inform and define our actions. People who understand the critical importance of metrics have accomplished impressive work. Just two quick examples. The Center for Sustainable Economy in the U.S. put together the Genuine Progress Indicator, which is also bringing it down to one number, just like GDP, but it is a very sophisticated metric that adds all activities that contribute to well-being and subtracts activities that are harmful. They add things like volunteer work or domestic labor, but subtract things like income inequality or air pollution. What their indicators show, among many other things, is that progress in the highly industrialized world essentially stopped sometime in the mid-1970s. The London-based New Economics Foundation, NEF, published a well-being manifesto that brims, I think, with wisdom and detailed recommendations, putting well-being front and center of political decision-making. Check it out. It's even a good read. Are any of these alternative sets of indicators perfect? Absolutely not. But they are all infinitely preferable to GDP. With smarter goals in place, we may discover that universal human needs for things like strong and sustainable communities, for the expansion of human capacities and meaningful work, can be realized only once we break the spell of the little big number. So permit me one final comment. We live in a time that seems to operate at a pace and scale that is almost gravity-defying. Therein lie, I would argue, both unparalleled dangers, but also unparalleled possibilities and opportunities. Yes, as the Pope just recently reminded us, quote, our common home is at a breaking point, burdened and laid waste. But having conquered scarcity as the driving engine of history, what amazing opportunities we have. Opportunities to create the kind of world John Stuart Mill, Karl Marx, John Maynard Keynes, and so many others invoked. A world in which human beings can finally graduate to more pleasant and more rewarding tasks than working just to put food on the table and pay the bills, keeping up with the Joneses, and staying on top of your emails and Facebook contacts. Opportunities to develop dormant human potentials. And perhaps most importantly, to live in some kind of harmony with nature and not in conflict. Above all, toward a future that will provide opportunities to our children and grandchildren at least equal to our own. Surely, there's more to life than growing economic output. As my colleague Brent Lane concluded after reading my book, it is time to retire GDP and its bag of assumptions as Grandpa's definition of prosperity. Thank you.
A fascinating and very enjoyable run through. You very powerfully made the case there for a complete reappraisal of GDP. And you talked a little bit about some of the alternatives, and many of which we've talked about. Many people have come to the RSA, as you say, Kate Raworth and a number of others, around the credible alternatives. Something that struck me, though, and I'm very interested to understand where you think the kind of sources of influence are for making this change, is when I looked at your pictures that you raised there of the 15 key influences on our economic thinking, and you as an economic historian will be fully aware of them at all. Only 15% of them were women. So you had Rosa Luxemburg and Eleanor Ostrom there.
Right.
Now, in terms of voice, in terms of who makes this choice, who thinks about what this reappraisal of GDP is, and who has that credible way of actually moving it forward, how would you approach representation to ensure that this dialogue gets beyond the campaign and into right. the mainstream?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And in fact, I'm struggling with this. I have a research project where I'm trying to bring around the table people to talk about possible alternative metrics. And part of the problem is that when you go to conferences on economic indicators, particularly in the U.S., and I hope this is a little different in the U.K., predictably what you will find is like 90% of them are my demographics, right? They're white, male, upper middle class. People that, you know, may be interesting to have at the table, but the vast majority of people who really need to be at the table, young people in particular, are missing. So it's an enormous problem that with modern politics in general. So, you know, what happens inside the Beltway in Washington, for instance, is largely not only dominated by that demographic, but is also sort of a wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America. So particular voices representing a very small sliver of society are always present, and the rest of the people are just simply not at the table. That is the key challenge, I think, that we face. And, you know, there are... It's interesting when you look at the papers of record or CNN or BBC or something, a lot of the voices are also missing from the public conversation, even though there are millions of people and millions of initiatives that are doing fabulous work. What they are not is connected and related, and they have not been able to figure out how to, you know, turn this into, for lack of a better term, a movement. So, you know, in the end, I guess I will take the way out and say I'm an historian. I'm terribly bad at predicting, and I'm not a public policy person. So I really wanted to lay out the fact that there is there's a history that I think we all need to know about, one. Two, that history provides us with unique opportunities by focusing on this core metric, rather than, you know, doing all these different things on the margins that generate knowledge but have very little impact on policymaking. So what we really need to do is replace GDP with a smarter metric, and even if it is something that we still have problems with, but there are many that really would make it, that would be a huge step in the right direction.
I mean, as you say, there are many. There's the kind of conscious capitalism movement. There's the, you know, post-growth. There's the circular economy. We have studies on that here in ourselves. But there is no one single powerful paradigm or ideology that is so adhered to globally. But I'm interested, in your book, you talked about the cataclysmic events that led to this metric. So sometimes I think we can focus overly on the metric being changed. So how do we create an alternative measure? So the Sarkozy-Stiglitz Commission came out with an alternative measure. Right. Many countries adopted or thought through what alternative measures would look like. But I was very taken by what you had said there about an operating system, because actually alternative measures aren't necessarily providing an alternative operating system.
Right.
And if you think about actually dramatic or disruptive shifts, a dramatic or disruptive shift in an alternative universe of computing is the collapse of Windows as the primary operating system, you know, and actually the move to mobile devices and how that's had, you know, a cataclysmic event of the change of operating system. So the question being, do we need another cataclysmic event that is, you know, a global war, or do we need a cataclysmic operating system change which is silent in its nature, but actually is just by starting to use the alternative?
It sounds to me that you're insisting on asking the historian to predict speculate about the future. But so let me, a couple of things. One of the things that I'm trying to contribute with this book is that we need to shift the conversation from thinking about GDP only as a metric, only as a measure, only as an economic indicator, because it is much more. It is a prescriptive tool, and it is essentially the goal of economic activities. And as such, it literally defines what we mean when we talk about the economy. And so when you and I have a conversation about the official economy, what we ultimately mean, though we may not know that, is that which is measured by GDP. So things that you and I do in our families or in our churches or in our community groups or in our unions or whatever is not part of it. Right? So in that sense, the key challenge will be to change that operating system, to change that logic, rather than just to come up with ever more measures. Right? We have very good measures by now that tell us a lot about the health of the ecosystem, the health of our communities, and so on and so forth, but they don't really impact policymaking. That's the critical problem.
So we need the Steve Jobs approach of someone just saying, I'm going to design the future and eradicate the past. Questions? We have one there.
Thank you. You make the point about being a historian. Is it not possible to look back at previous GDP numbers over the past and deconstruct it, and at least take out some of the things you think are being measured potentially in a damaging way? Your example of the driving and the lawyers that get involved, if you reworked it and looked at history and said, actually, if we took out the negative impact and we looked at what we thought we were reporting to be good news and growth and saw it again in a new light, would that have given us a different view on the world, and would other decisions and point of view on how successful we've been, would that not at least inform the discussion and say, don't look at the measures we're using today as actually representing success? It's just a thought to look at it in a retrospective way.
No, absolutely right, and people have done this. And so, you know, what I was trying to show you with GPI very briefly, they actually took those metrics and went backwards. And this is how they figured out that from 45 to about mid-60s or so, GPI and GDP moved in parallel in the same direction. And then they began to diverge a great deal. And so by 1970 or so, GPI flattened out and is now actually going down because they use a more sophisticated metric while GDP, of course, keeps going up. So absolutely, yeah.
Rowan, the point you made about a cataclysmic event, could that possibly be food riots? I'm thinking of the huge reduction in fruit and vegetable production in California over the past 3 years because of water shortage. The fact that it seems that wheat can't be grown in the central belt of America and would have to move north. Right. And the fact that America keeps increasing its import of food to meet demand from poor countries like Mexico. Mm-hmm. So eventually, the natural resources that are going to pertain in those instances will need to a redefinition of how we grow, won't it? And won't it bring to light some of the points you've raised about the social implications of GDP and the nature and the way in which we measure things?
I mean, there are so many crises, right? Food is one, and water is one, and of course, the UK and the US are also exporting their carbon footprint to other nations and then claim that they're making progress when, in fact, they're not, because they're just sort of, you know, putting their production facilities somewhere else. I think that there are lots of potential crises that can wake us up, but you know, my sense is that the problem really is not so much of lack of understanding or lack of awareness, at least not when I travel, as much as it is literally a problem even among the best and brightest who are sitting around the table of not knowing what to do, right? Not knowing how to translate idea into action. That is the biggest problem, and that is, you know, that's a political problem. It's a movement problem, ultimately.
So Rowan's point pertains
there. Absolutely, yeah. And so, you know, crises can bring that about, but crises in and of themselves don't organize people. Right? They may spark more awareness and more sense of urgency, but they don't exactly tell you exactly what to do when you walk out the room. And so here's where we need to do a lot of work. And in part, what I'm interested in and what my work is in part trying to address is we have sort of a huge dichotomy between sort of the practical world of adults and policymakers and, you know, who are living in their box and they work with the way the world works. And then we have movement activists and we have academics and, you know, lots of knowledge and lots of theory, but the two hardly ever meet. And so what we really need to do is come up with much more practical policy initiatives as to how these ideas can be translated into action on a wide level of things.
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, really, really powerful for me. Thank you very much. I was going to pick up, as you suggested, some of the stuff that you mentioned that we can clean up a bit, as it were, and also looking backwards rather than asking you to anticipate forward. You said deeply internalized assumptions, and you also said that we were assuming that people weren't insane. And Wilhelm Wundt in the end of the 19th century started looking at introspection. So is it interesting as a historian that by the mid-1970s, I did a PhD on environmental psychology, being fed up with architecture and its lack of interest in people, for example. So would it be interesting that in the mid-1970s, psychology became entirely metric? And your comment on the idea that we are the operating systems, and at the moment we seem to have an intense interest in forensic analysis rather than dialectical interpretation.
Nature of metrics.
You raise a lot of very important questions. So just a couple of thoughts on this. I mean, as a people, we have sort of an intense need to think that stuff makes sense and that it can be put into systems and numbers and mathematical models. And, of course, more often than not, we realize that that just doesn't work. And so, you know, anything that we can do to help people realize that, you know, we need to look behind the curtain. And we need to look, I mean, Piketty's book in part became so famous because at least he made the very essential point that these models are based on assumptions that are deeply flawed. Right? By deeply internalized, of course, I mean that even experts, I mean, I was 3 years into the work on this book. I had my son in the back seat of the car. It was spring of 2009. I picked him up from soccer practice, football. And NPR, National Public Radio, said GDP is up, finally, after the Great Recession. I was like, yes! And I went like, oh, wait. Right? And I was too embarrassed to go home and tell my wife about this episode. But so it's deeply internalized, and it has a lot of psychological phenomena, part of which also is sort of a connection to these numbers that we always want to go up. And this phenomenon, you know, across the board in academics, there is a phenomenon of detaching what we do from the sweaty, messy, real life of real people. And, you know, putting it into nice little neat mathematical models in psychology and sociology and economics is a nice way to do it, but it forever further removes us from what is really relevant, I think.
Welcome to London.
a place where GDP actually measures as a soaring wealth produced by the financial sector, but actually doesn't reflect growing homelessness and inequality that you see all around us here. Now, a point I want to make is really, as a historian, you must have noticed that there are pre-capitalist cultures that have actually come up with different measurements, if you like. And one of those, a famous one, is the sort of Iroquois social charter of you make social and economic decisions based on what's going to happen to seven generations hence. Right. And that only decisions, you know, decisions are only valid if they actually don't have a damaging impact on future generations. Well, we certainly capitalism today is not predicated on that basis. I think the measurement, as you're coming around to saying, is not the problem. It's a systemic problem. And the system, you mentioned Marx, not buried far away from here, believe that accumulation essentially was at the heart of the system. It was only that remorseless accumulation that would be, you know, the GDP is essentially reflecting. It is a problem of the system. Now, how are we going to get, if you like, to a prescriptive type of measurement, rather like the Iroquois had, rather like the models that you had, you showed there, without some sort of battle? Because basically the entrenched social interests that you've alluded to, the big corporations, they're not going to give up their growth model in a hurry. And I think that is the problem that we're essentially facing.
I'm ready for the fight. So again, I mean, I don't really know how to answer that question. It's just, you know, let me share a couple of thoughts along those lines. We tend to be very impatient. The minute we begin to realize that we have a problem, we want to fix. We want a solution. And then the next step oftentimes is, oh my God, it's difficult. And how is this going to work? And their entrenched interests and their big powers and so on and so forth. It may not be possible. So one thought. I think we can demonstrate beyond reasonable doubt today that the only thing that is unrealistic is to stay on the path we're on. And I have no idea whether any alternatives may or may not work. But the one that I know will not work is the one we're on. So that's a good starting point, I think. Two, I am surprised. I mean, I teach and work at a private elite university in the U.S. And so one of the, whatever you want to call that, one of the aspects of that job is that I get to be around rich and powerful people a lot. And it is interesting for me to find out that when I give a presentation like this to a room full of CEOs, they actually have very sympathetic responses. Why? Because they feel schizophrenic and torn, because they live two different identities. One as citizens or fathers or mothers or brothers or whatever, where they know that this is really dangerous, what we're doing. And then they go back to the boardroom and they fulfill the necessities and imperatives of growth and profit and so on, right? Which is in conflict with what they actually believe. So I think that there are there's an enormous amount of awareness. What is missing and what I think the book can help focus on is, again, that we don't know where to start and we don't know how to do it. Your larger question about capitalism, I don't really have an answer to this. I think capitalism has morphed quite a bit. One of the things about Marx that is, you know, most people don't really understand is that he was a great fan of capitalism, as long as it was just sort of a temporary phenomenon because it created the preconditions for the possibility, right? And so growth has provided us with enormous possibilities. There's no question. But it's also no question that we have to move on. Whether that can happen within a system that you might end up calling capitalism or not, I'm not sure. But the operating logic of capitalism is not so much profit right now as much as it is GDP growth. Right? Very narrowly defined. That's what we really need to give up on, I think.
I'm afraid we only have time for one more question because we're really close to running out, so...
Thank you. My question concerns three of your fellow Americans. 1960s, Simon Kuznets
made an analysis of GDP very similar to your own. Basically, he said it wasn't being used for the purposes for which it was designed, and that was 50 years ago. 4 years ago here in London, Al Gore said that if we don't get off our addiction to GDP in the next 10 years, i.e. in the next 6 years from now, then the sort of climate change and inequality impacts would be catastrophic. 2 years ago, I was at the launch, the London launch of Michael Porter's Social Progress Index, and that is now, it's a coming together of a 50-odd social and environmental metrics, but it's being used as a tool for development, particularly South American countries taking it up, even regional governments within Brazil having their own measures. Given that that's the state of play, and given there's a degree of urgency, I appreciate what you said about being a historian, but if you had to opt now for the solution that was going to take us into a better way forward, which group of metrics would you choose? And would Social Progress Index be high on that list?
Predict and commit.
I like many of them. And the social progress indicators that Michael Porter has put together are certainly a very good start. I mean, if some cataclysmic event happened tomorrow morning 8 o'clock and we had to come up with one metric that replaces GDP, I would probably go with GPI, which I think is the most seasoned and the most well thought through and provides a metric that is actually operational for policymakers. But it has lots of problems. But it is also something that I think could be adapted to regional and national conditions, and it is very open to development and growth and expansion. And I think it's a very smart metric that could get us a long way towards that.
Well, there we go. With caveats, there was a commitment there. We've really run out of time, so we'll have to wrap up. Thank you all for coming and for an excellent session within such hot conditions. I appreciate that none of you fainted. Thank you very much for that. Please note that The Little Big Number, the Dirk's book, is a formidable book, and I would recommend it highly, will be for sale outside the auditorium, and I believe you'll sign it for anyone who would choose to buy one. So please join me again in thanking today's terrific speaker, Dirk Philipson.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.